For too many of us, it's become safer to retreat into our own bubbles, whether in our neighborhoods or on college campuses or places of worship, or especially our social media feeds. Surrounded by people who look like us and share the same political outlook and never challenge our assumptions. And increasingly, we become so secure in our bubbles that we start accepting only information, whether it's true or not, that fits our opinions, instead of basing our opinions on the evidence that is out there. In the course of a healthy debate, we prioritize different goals and the different means of reaching them. But without some common baseline of facts, without a willingness to admit new information and concede that your opponent might be making a fair point, if you're tired of arguing with strangers on the internet, try talking with one of them in real life.
It'll be too easy to talk about nothing, to talk about nothing. Be too easy to talk like I'm something. I'm balling, I'm stunting. Be too easy, chasing the fame, playing the game. It'll be too easy, but tell them we don't feel that. No, no, tell them we don't feel that.
Well, hey, everybody. Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. I am your host, Calvin Moore, and as semi-always, I am here with my co-host, Kent Strage.
Almost always.
Thank you for the correction.
Mm-hmm. Semi would mean like half the time.
Does it?
Well, semi-annual means like half a year. So semi-always.
I thought biannual meant.
That's once every 2 years.
Biannual is every 2 years. Semi-annual would. Yeah, so semi-always would mean, you know, sometimes.
Okay.
I'm almost
right.
Always.
Okay, fine. That's fair. How's your week been? Been good?
It's been good, although I got to tell you, I have a long, detailed story to tell. No, I don't. I was just going to say, I've been planning all week to respond to your "How you doing, Kent?" with a full... with a full 30-second rap lyric, and I chickened out right at the end.
Oh, come on. You got to do it sometime. Surprise me.
I will. I will do it sometime.
Okay, it's got to be within the next, like, year now so that I've forgotten about it.
Fair enough.
It can't be, like, next week because I'll be expecting it.
It was, spoiler alert, it was going to be from Hamilton.
Well, that's not really a spoiler at all.
And I was going to do it because we didn't mention it at all last week.
We didn't?
Mm-mm.
Oh, okay. So. I feel like a bad host. We mention Hamilton every single episode, and
thus far,
I guess semi. We do it semi.
Right. It's more than half the time.
Anyhow, last week was a great conversation. I had a really good conversation about fat shaming. Loved having the ladies on and the gentlemen on to talk about that. But this week we are going to be having our second episode of Muslim in America. So Muslim in America Part 2. And this week we are focusing on Islam and politics. And it's kind of interesting. Again, last time we did Muslim in America, the Muslim ban happened. And we had already scheduled it out and didn't know that was going to happen. And then this week, I didn't know when I scheduled this out that we would be in the month of Ramadan.
Because Ramadan is very unpredictable. And not, you can't look it up.
Well, yeah, you can, but you know, I wasn't
no way to tell
planning
us
it that way.
That
and so,
dude, everything's on Google.
Yeah. I guess so.
Google it, man.
To our panelists today, Ramadan Mubarak. Is that correct?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, cool. So, and then I guess African American Muslims or Black Muslims generally say Ramadan Kareem. I found that out a few days ago.
They can say either one. Ramadan Mubarak means congratulations on Ramadan. Ramadan Kareem means happy Ramadan.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right, cool. So I'm going to say both at some point. So later on, I'll say Ramadan Kareem to end things.
Well, the advanced courses, you say Festivus Kareem.
I don't think that's true. That one I know is not true.
It is in the Gulf.
Okay, so this week we are talking about Islam and politics, and we've got four great guests. One of them is not here yet. She will be here in just a few moments. But we'll just kind of go over our bios real quick, and then we'll dive right into questions. So Fatina, I'm probably going to mispronounce her name. I hope I don't. Abdurabah, I believe that's how you pronounce her last name.
Abdurabah.
Oh, Abdurabah. Okay, there it is. Yes, I left off a letter when I put it out there. But Fatina is praised as one of the Muslim American community's rising women to watch. She is currently executive director of AMAL, the American Muslim and Minority Advocacy League. Amal is a grassroots civil rights organization. She is also an adjunct professor of law at Wayne State Law School, where she taught the first of its kind course on Sharia law, which is great because we're going to be talking about Sharia a little bit later on the back half of the show. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Christian Science Monitor, Boston Globe, and she's been a regular guest columnist in the Detroit Free Press on topics ranging from the Sterling Heights Mosque controversy, segregationist symbols in Dearborn, and women in Islam. In addition to practicing law, she has graduate degrees in theology and public policy. She has a pedigree that includes degrees from Harvard University, University of Pennsylvania, and the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. Next up, Mr. Razi Jaffrey. Razi Jaffrey is a Detroit-based educator, photographer, and entrepreneur. In the past, Razi has worked with the international microlending nonprofit Kiva.org. Razi, that is where I met you. That's where I met you for the first time. Oh, my gosh. Okay, when I met him, I was like, this guy's familiar. I met you. You spoke at a Kiva event that Build and Detroit Experience Factory were going to a long time ago.
Yes.
He has also taught STEM at a Detroit high school this past year. He was a member of the Spring 2016 Fellowship in Human-Centered Design at Sevilla, a center for social innovation. He is also currently working on a social impact mobile app for purchasing meals for the needy at restaurants, coffee shops, and food trucks. Razi, thanks so much for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Next up, we have Mr. Saeed Khan. Saeed Khan is a senior lecturer of Near East and Asian Studies at Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan, where he teaches Islamic and Middle East history, politics, and culture, and where he is also a fellow at the Center for the Study of Citizenship. He is an adjunct professor at Rochester College, my alma mater, where he co-teaches a course on Christian-Muslim dialogue. He is also honorary fellow at Australian Catholic University in Melbourne, Australia, and lots of other cool things. Saeed, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
And last but not least, on the Skype line, we have Mr. Solomon Rajput. Solomon Rajput graduated from Dartmouth College in 2014. He worked as an organizer on the Hillary campaign and was among the top three organizers in the state of Michigan. He introduced President Obama at a campaign rally in front of 10,000 people. He's a founder of the Michigan Resistance, which has helped volunteers make tens of thousands of calls to legislators to promote progressive policies. He is the CEO of a mobile app. Hey, so you and Ron, you guys should talk. Of a mobile app company called Diets Suck. And he is starting medical school at the University of Michigan this fall. Solomon, thanks so much for calling in.
It's much more clever
name. Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So let's dive right into questions then. And Fatina, thanks so much for being able to join us here. She just walked in. Let's dive right into the first question here. When it comes to the political process, what issues tend to matter most in Muslim households? Are there any recurring themes? And the question comes from this idea that, okay, I was raised in a Christian home, and when I'm in a conservative Christian circles, legislation surrounding abortion and homosexuality tend to be the things that are the hills that we're willing to die on. That's always coming up.
And guns.
Right, yeah. You know, a Supreme Court nominee could change Roe v. Wade and all that stuff.
Guns.
Yes. guns as well. So are there any issues that matter most in Muslim households? What are the thoughts that come up around these topics? And we don't have to speak in any particular order. Anybody can jump in here.
I think maybe I'll just start off with saying that you can't talk about issues in Muslim households, and let's just say in the United States, without talking about the diversity of Muslim households in the United States. And so there isn't a sizable majority of any ethnic community. Demographic differences across socioeconomic classes as well. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the more pertinent issues for Muslim households are going to depend on the circumstances of those individual households. So okay. An African-American Muslim family living on the east side of Detroit are going to be the issues that are most of concern to them are going to be quite different than the concerns of a family living in West Bloomfield.
Okay.
And so I just want to maybe lay that out there before we get into the specifics.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think the question is more, I guess, getting at, yeah, and I definitely don't assume that all Muslim families are just monolithic. Obviously, mm-hmm. The question kind of feels that way. But, you know, again, the last time that we did this, the Muslim ban happened. I would assume that would be a big issue for all Muslims across the board. Like, okay, that's a huge issue. Immigration might be an issue. I don't know.
Yeah.
So I guess that's kind of what the question's getting at there. I don't want to assume that all Muslims are the same.
Sure.
But are there any recurring themes that you can walk into a Muslim circle and know, I'm not going to hear this in a Jewish circle. I'm not going to hear this necessarily in an African-American circle.
To piggyback on what Razi said, and this is Saeed, I mean, immigration wouldn't necessarily be much of an issue for, say, an African-American Muslim family, whereas it probably would be for an immigrant family that has ties to other countries. But one thing that we have seen recently, and particularly since 9/11, is the increase in a lot of hard data on the Muslim American community. I mean, I'll make a disclaimer here because I was one of the founders of this organization, the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding. ISPU has done a lot of studies on looking at the political landscape of Muslim Americans. And what it has found is an astoundingly similar track when it comes to issues. So the economy, education, healthcare, civil rights, to some degree foreign policy, particularly as it pertains to domestic policy, these are the top five issues that Muslim Americans find as being their priorities, which you're going to find as being eerily similar to broader society. That what that also shows, though, is that the Muslim American community, as what Ruzzi was alluding to, is A, not a monolith, B, it doesn't see itself politically as necessarily a religious community like Christian communities.
Okay.
And also, it is not a single issue political entity. So you can't say it as being a an abortion issue or a gun rights issue or a homosexuality. In fact, those tend to poll very low when it comes to the social issues on the minds and in the imagination of Muslims.
Interesting. Okay. Solomon, you're about to you're about to speak up there. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. So it's interesting. I mean, I just really know my experience, my family experience, our close friends and family. I haven't done any studies or anything like that. But when I'm thinking about what issues are important to me, the fact that I'm Muslim, like, hardly ever factors into it, which is, like, I guess kind of going off of what the two other guests were talking about. You know, it's just like my religious beliefs don't really play too much into my opinions or my stances on issues. But there is one big exception for our family, which is that, especially growing up in the post 9/11 world, and where we were seeing, you know, increasingly anti-Muslim rhetoric and sentiment from conservative talk shows and conservative politicians, it just became kind of common sense that for us and in our community that we would all be liberal and Democrats, because the other side, like, often just makes it just feels like the other side doesn't want us. So that is a big part of it, the fact that to be Muslim, if someone was to tell me that they're Muslim and Republican, I'd be like, do you watch the news? You know, like, I mean, do you know that people are, like,
that's how black people feel too, just so you know. We're in solidarity there. I said, that's how black people feel as well. Just, we're in solidarity there.
Yeah, exactly. Because, and I mean, like, there were a few, like, very, very few people who came on the TV during this past election cycle. And they said they were Muslim, and they were also, like, for Donald Trump, after Donald Trump was saying all these crazy things about how Islam hates us and how we need to, like, you know, put a ban on all Muslims coming to this country, which was, like, you know, it was, like, hard stuff to hear, right? And everyone was just so confused. They're like, do you live under a rock? You know what I mean? Like, how could you be a Muslim and also supporting these policies, but more disappointing this party that, like, really hates you? So that's kind of, I think, the party affiliation, it affects a lot more, I feel like, than actual just policies.
Okay.
And for me personally.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and I think Razi touched on this, but it's something I think more than we should kind of gloss over. It's not so much to be defensive that, of course, we're not all monolithic, and, you know, that every topic or conversation on Muslims needs to be, you know, with a nuance or fleshed out, you know, beyond, like, what do Muslims think. But it's very important that we pause with almost every question as it relates to Muslims, and I think this is what Razi was getting at, is that we're not a monolith. It's almost like before you answer the question, you have to say, but we're not a monolith, because there's this underlying bias and premise as it relates to Muslims that whether it comes about a question in terms of their engagement with the political process or their belief systems or their spectrum of even economic classes, that we are somehow a monolith. So I want to go back to kind of what Razi said, which is we're not, and there tends to be this cast around and surrounding Muslims that they are. But another important question, important point, and Saeed talked about this in terms of some of the hard data. Yeah, naturally, Muslims care about healthcare and education and, you know, all the stuff that you talk about, anybody would talk about over the dinner table. But this idea that we're somehow, you know, forever linked to foreign lands, right? That we can't possibly just be American Muslims sitting in, you know, Royal Oak and care about issues just related to down the street. It's important that the ISPU, fantastic group, I agree, Saeed, kudos to you guys. The data has shown that to the extent that we care about foreign, I guess, you know, international issues, they're almost always linked to their residual impact on domestic issues. So, for example, if American Muslims do care very much about the Arab-Israeli process, it's insofar as the trickle-down residual is how you know, profiling issues impact Muslims in this country, or the idea of just having a voice in Washington and elsewhere. So, you know, I guess it's a long about way of saying American Muslims certainly care about Iraq and Syria and the homelands that, for some, it's their great-great-grandparents came from. Mm-hmm. It's that far back. But to the extent that they do care, it's always, almost always rooted in a local concern.
And I think that's such a great point, because Muslim Americans, like all Americans, have the right to care about American foreign policy. So there shouldn't necessarily be a disqualification. At the same time, being American also means that it's not just limited to one area of foreign policy. For example, one doesn't have to have any kind of a vested interest to protest the Vietnam War, for example, when it happened in the right. 1960s and 70s. So similarly, I think what we're finding is in America the landscape by which Muslims negotiate foreign policy as being stakeholders of the American political exercise is also very important.
It's kind of interesting that you brought that up, because, I mean, just until this moment, when I think about if I care about foreign policy, you know, okay, if I care about America's relationship with its allies or with its enemies, that's just me caring about foreign policy. If it is a Muslim caring about, you know, what's happening in the Middle East, I can care about what's happening in the Middle East. And people are like, oh, you know, you're a good American for thinking about what's going on and think about foreign policy. This is great. If Muslim people do it, it's like, you know, why aren't you really American? You know, do you really have loyalty to us if you're thinking about, you know, Middle Eastern country? You're like, oh, I'm talking about Syria and I'm from Afghanistan. You know, what is it? I mean, and so there's this question of loyalty when Muslim people think about foreign policy issues. Whereas I think when everyone else, we just kind of get a pass and our loyalty is in question. At least that's kind of this theme that I'm kind of seeing rise to the fore.
There are other groups, to be fair, that are accused of quote-unquote dual loyalty. I think, unfortunately, the Jewish American community oftentimes has to endure this still.
Okay. All
right. That for them, when they're looking at Israel, if there was an issue in which there was daylight between the United States and Israel on a policy matter, it seems as though there's at least always a tacit inquisition that they might face as to, well, which one, if it came to choosing. And I think that that's certainly a situation that a lot of Muslim Americans, as you said, face. That doesn't mean that Muslims should have to go off the radar and find something really very different in order to show their loyalty by finding out, you know, volcanoes in Iceland as a foreign policy issue.
Okay.
So my favorite part of that, this question, which just wrapped up, is when I said nothing at all. moving on to our next question, and I will preface this with two things. One, that Muslims are not a monolith, which we covered. and two, we are at a specific point in American history where one of our major political parties has a quasi-official stance, we hate you. That being the case, do Muslim households generally tend to be more politically conservative or politically liberal?
Well, the party that you're talking about, Kent, this is Saeed again.
Be the Socialist Party of America.
Well, that particular party and, wow, GOP, oops, it might surprise some that even at the last election in 2016, here in Michigan, 23% of the Muslim vote went to Donald Trump. So again, yeah, I know. I see Kent here who seems completely boggled by that fact. I'd like to go ahead and unpack that question, because
in a related story, 23% of Muslims apparently watch The Apprentice and do not watch the news. That's the only
Okay. That's the only channel they get. Yes. Well, we have to also consider when we're talking about political conservatism or political liberalism, are we talking about social conservatism and liberalism? Are we talking about fiscal socialism and conservatism and liberalism? It's a very complicated thing. One thing I can say is that up until the year 2000, the vast majority of immigrant Muslims, and this has been documented, voted for the Republican Party.
Right.
And part of that was that they bought into this schoolhouse rock mythos of pull yourself up by the bootstraps, an entrepreneurial spirit, land of opportunity, yada, yada, yada.
I don't think that's just Muslims, because what you were just talking about, I remember very clearly at, I want to say, the 2004 Republican convention, Arnold Schwarzenegger, an Austrian immigrant, yep, told that exact same story.
Sure.
About that's why he was a Republican.
And it was a point where there was quite a cleavage with the immigrant Muslim and the African-American Muslim, because the African-American Muslim community, by and large, coming out of the whole civil rights era, were voting Democratic.
Mm-hmm.
And we find that 9/11 changes everything. And so we find that in subsequent elections, by and large, immigrant Muslims are trending more to vote for the Democratic Party. And part of it, Candace, I think, as you said, this idea that they are considered pariahs by one of the major political parties, and the African American community within the Muslim community has stayed relatively consistent as well by voting on the Democratic side.
Hmm. Anyone else thoughts?
I think, you know, it's one of the reasons why it's so perhaps disturbing or surprising to learn about these statistics that 23% of Muslim households Muslims voted for Donald Trump in the last election, considering the rhetoric that was coming out, you know.
So you don't have to be very good at math to know that Muslims are the reason Donald Trump is president.
All right, we'll take that one.
Okay.
Sure. You know, because we haven't been dumped on enough.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Wow. That's – but I mean, there were a lot of people that I think voted for him, and I was surprised at the percentages of women that voted for him. Mm-hmm. I was surprised by that. I think any percentage, anything above 1% is a surprise to me of any group voting for him, but that's just because I – philosophically disagree with him, and I think that he said a lot of xenophobic and racist and homophobic and sexist stuff along the campaign trail. But this isn't about bashing Donald Trump. I think that the way that well, he's like, well, Solomon, what do you want to say there?
Yeah, at that point, no. So I, you know, I just talked about like my experience, my family's experience, and yeah, I mean, we are, you know, immigrants from Pakistan. My parents moved here when. Right before I was born, and I and we very strongly feel like, well, I mean, you know, of course we're going to be Democrats because that's a place for us in the American political landscape. So that definitely rings true with us. But it was very interesting when I was working on the Hillary campaign, and we were actually out in the communities trying to register voters and get people to, you know, come out and vote for Hillary. We did run into not many, but some Muslim people who just felt like so disenfranchised with politics and with American policies, and just didn't think that they really had a voice. So some people were just considering that I talked to vote for. They were considering voting for Donald Trump because they just thought at the end of the day nothing really mattered, which was sad, honestly. You know, because I was working on the campaign and we were really trying to encourage people to come out and vote and saying that, like, their voice does matter and that Michigan does matter as a battleground state. But a lot of people just, like, they felt like, you know, like, what's the point where it doesn't matter. We just had 8 years of a Democrat. Maybe we'll just try something with Donald Trump so he can shake things up. So, and I mean, I was devastated to hear that. But we tried really hard to convince people otherwise. Some people were just set in their ways, I guess.
Yeah, I think that that kind of demoralized spirit, when the numbers did come out that it was about 23% of Muslims voted for Donald Trump, you know, we had some of these backroom conversations, and a lot of it did just come from that very place. Like, look, you know, at least he's honest about how much he hates us, right? I mean, people really did say that. You know, religious men with long beards said, look, at least we know he's very vocal about how much he hates us, and as opposed to, you know, other politicians who you see this language of diversity wrapped very politely, but it's, you know, always an underlying kind of jab to diversity altogether. Or this idea that, you know, Hillary was simply going back to kind of foreign policy, was way too hawkish on, you know, several of the Middle Eastern countries, and that at least with Trump, you know, maybe he hated Muslims here or wanted to put a ban together. And I'm not trying to be flippant about that, but frankly, that he was going to do that. But at least, you know, maybe it'd be a fresh slate or a fresh start for something, for one of the countries, for one of the, you know. So amidst all this really was like this desperate kind of pleading with, I guess, just to be frank, it can't be worse, right? At least he's being direct into our face and, you know, he hates a bunch of us equally. Us being, you know, different groups.
Yeah, so
of,
when crazy stuff happens, you're not surprised. You're like, oh, okay.
There was that. Almost negotiating, you know, kind of like a grieving process. You know, you deny and then you accept and then you kind of negotiate. So there definitely was. But it also speaks to that very American kind of demoralized, disenfranchisedness with the system that Muslims are not immune to.
And what's fascinating what you're about what you're saying there, this kind of response, also Solomon, what you were saying there, this disenfranchisement. Oh, well, you know, hey, you know, we had 8 years of a Democrat. You know, let's try something new. I think it's the same thing. I mean, obviously, Barack Obama, his first African-American president, that was kind of a big historic moment. My dad, lifetime Republican, as far as I understand, voted Democrat for the first time. You know, the second time he didn't, but the first time he's like, hey, this is historic, we've got to do this. But there is kind of this idea of, you know, okay, 8 years of Republican, we're done with that. Let's do, you know, 8 years of Barack Obama. Okay, now we're tired of 8 years of Barack Obama. I almost feel like there's nothing more American than being tired of the political party that's been in power for as long as I've had a rather
extraordinary run of good health. And I'm thinking of shaking things up with some botulism. I mean, just to see how it goes. Can't be that bad, right?
Well, any dented cans in the room?
So Solomon, one of the things that you had said earlier was when you're thinking about the political process, your religion doesn't play much into your thinking. It's like, hey, you know, this is what I think fiscally. This is what I think, you know, about women's rights. This is what I think about reproductive rights. This is what I think about, you know, the Muslim ban, whatever. Your religion doesn't really play into that decision-making process, which is, again, another fascinating thing for someone like me to hear, because I grew up in predominantly white evangelical culture where, again, the hill to die on was homosexuality, abortion, and, you know, I don't care what Trump is saying, the Supreme Court nominee. Supreme Court, you know, he can grab as many women as he wants as long as the Supreme Court nominee overturns Roe v. Wade. You know, that's the hill I'm willing to die on. 20 years ago, what was his name? James Dobson. You know,
still his name.
But what was his name? Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton having sex in the Oval Office with Monica Lewinsky and James Dobson coming out and saying, hey, you know what? He's disqualified from being the president on moral grounds. Fast forward 20 years and got all this audio coming out about Donald Trump and same guy says, well, we're not voting for a pastor-in-chief. So there's kind of this, you know, abandonment of your faith and your values for power.
If we can parse that those two statements to death, is it possible that the Oval Office is very, very important to Dr. Dobson?
I don't know.
Okay.
I can't tell. Well, no, I can tell. Yes, it is. It's very important.
No, but I'm saying the fact that it – never mind.
I'm missing it. But either way.
Okay, all right.
But either way, in the circles that I grew up in – I'm thinking along a particular trajectory and you're throwing me off, so that's why. In the circles that I grew up in and still very much swim in with some of the people that I know and can't know some of these people as well, your faith is an integral part of the voting process. Christians believe in deep participation in the political sphere. When I looked up the backgrounds of our U.S. senators right now, all of them except four have a – oh, no, I'm sorry. Most of them have a religious affiliation that is Christian. There are a few Jewish people. There are three unaffiliated, and there is one Buddhist in the United States Senate. There are no Muslims. We'll talk about that in the fourth question. But what role do you believe religion should play in the shaping of public policy? Because our morals come from our religious background. Right now, you are celebrating Ramadan. I'm assuming something spiritual reality comes out of this. Okay, you know, maybe For some people, it's just not eating. For some people, it's, you know, it's a spiritual exercise, right?
I get spiritual once I get some food in my stomach.
Okay, well, that's good. But there's something to that. It informs your day-to-day activity. Your religion informs you enough that you're not eating right now, right? You know, so that then something's supposed to come out of that. And so when Christians go to the voting booth, it's like, hey, you know, my morality tells me that life begins in, you know, at conception, and so abortion's a big issue. They're voting on a moral issue from a Christian standpoint. And they vote for people, and they vote for policies and against policies based on what their religious beliefs teach them. So what role do you all believe that, you know, religion should play in the shaping of public policy, if any?
Well, first of all, I think that it's not so much about what, I don't know, maybe not what role, but how much of it. I mean, let's be honest. Religion, and even the absence of religion, still provides, as you said, a morality and a moral compass and an outlook. So inevitably, whatever is your ideology, you're bringing it into the voting booth. You're bringing it into how you see every issue coming before you. It's essentially the lens through which you're looking at the world around you.
Right.
To me, if I look at myself from the standpoint of a pie chart, I don't know how much of my decision-making is shaded religion. I mean, I'm a Muslim, but I'm also a Keynesian when it comes to my economic outlook. I'm also a Foucauldian when it comes to my philosophical outlook. I'm also a Manchester United fan. I mean, you know, there's a lot.
Soccer. Sorry. Moving on.
Well, so now we see politically conservative as well. but I don't know. It's kind of like if somebody asks you, so what language do you dream in? Or you know, what language do you think in? I mean, it's just something that's intuitive. And I think one's religious orientation is that intuitive. It's embedded, and it is certainly in their in the calculus of decision making and how one then approaches issues. I can't quantify that, though.
Yeah. Okay. You know, the other thing I wanted to add to what Saeed was talking about was the idea that, you know, whether you're talking about public policy or a general framework or a paradigm on how one views the world, let's not forget the role of one's social, environmental, and educational experiences that play in that. I think religion is one segment of that in terms of shaping one's view. Like I said, whether it's on public policy or whether it's on just a worldview, and you know, there's a couple of interesting examples that I thought of while we were having this conversation. And on the issue of gay marriage, I was thinking of two politicians in particular whose views, in terms of a public policy point of view, were shaped by the experiences of their own families or their own children. One being that of Dick Cheney. And the other one, that of being Dick Gephardt. So Democratic, you know, senator from Tennessee in a largely red state, has a gay daughter, and that shifts his entire view on the issue. And the same thing with Dick Cheney.
But Dick Cheney kept saying, "I still support the president." When they called him on that, they're like, "I support the president."
And yeah.
By the way, Senator Rob Portman of Ohio. I don't know about Dick Gephardt, but I know that Senator Rob Portman of Ohio said that his stance on gay marriage turned around when his son told him he was gay.
So, again, you know, one's own social experiences, even, you know, we're talking about now within one's own household, plays a major role in determining how favorable or unfavorable one's views are going to be on a political issue, despite the fact that there is a expectation according to party affiliation, based on what one's opinion should be or what one's public policy position should be on that. The social and personal experiences play a major role in that.
Okay.
And I think that we actually see that quite a bit. Like Tim Kaine, for example, during the 2016 election, he was for a hot second criticized that he personally was not pro-choice, even though he like supports pro-choice policies. And he said, like, because of my faith and my upbringing, my family and I would not ever, you know, my wife and I have decided or something that, like, you know, she would never have an abortion. I don't really know what he was saying, but he said that he personally doesn't believe that that was right for him and his family. but he said that he absolutely supported a pro-choice policy pretty much because, like, that was the Democratic expectation. And a pro-choice group rated him as very, very favorable in terms of the policies that he supported to their pro-choice agenda. So I think, I mean, it really is just what, like, to piggyback off on what another panelist said, it really is just such just one piece in your overall decision-making process, because, you know, it's all about, you know, where you came from, what your family is like, what your party expects of you, how much you want to be aligned with that party. But I think there is, it is possible to have kind of like a opinion for a policies at large versus for yourself and your family. Hmm. I think those can be different.
Okay. Athena?
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is really about labeling and how we label. How we label what is, you know, religious, what is moral, what is ideological, as one of the panelists said earlier. And sometimes these things kind of weave into each other. I'll give you an example. I'm a mom of young kids, and I can tell you, when you want to grapple with really the most existential kind of inner things that the human needs to think about in terms of identity and decency and who you want to be and where we need to go, you can get those questions posed by your six-year-old, you know, and you know, the idea of even social justice, right? When you think of social justice advocates or civil rights folks, to be stereotypical, sometimes, you know, we think of left-leaning on a lot of this stuff. But I mean, why is it not the framework that folks from otherwise traditional, you know, as for Muslims, I went to Muslim schools, for instance, I can't really identify, am I social justice oriented because I went to a Muslim school and we were taught to stand up for the downtrodden because we were Muslim, or were we taught to stand up just because you stand up because that's what good people do and that's what is just and right and fair? So, you know, I don't know if they were handing me the Quran and telling me to, you know, God says to fight for the less fortunate, or if they didn't hand the Quran and instead they said that they were just building and breeding people of good social conscience. So I think a lot of it in terms of this question of the role of religion, I think it's, you know, what exactly are we talking about here? A text, you know, an ideology, communities of you know, non-traditional religious folks. And the Muslims really have the spectrum of that.
Okay. Let's move on.
So we have yet to have a Muslim hold the highest state or national office in our system of government.
Well, the national office to some.
What?
Some people said that Barack Obama was a Muslim.
You know? Oh, yeah, okay. Like, oh, right.
He's a Muslim. We checked that off the list a long
time. Barack Hussein Obama.
You'll take him. We'll take him. So we have yet to officially have a Muslim hold the highest state or national office in the land. So we have never officially had a Muslim president, nor have we had a Muslim governor. Do you believe that a country such as this, which is officially secular, unofficially Christian, will ever see a person of Muslim faith achieve this?
I think so. I'm probably a little less hungry than Saeed now, so maybe I'm more optimistic midday as we break fast about 4 hours from now. But I think so. You know, I caveat, you know, that with the disclaimer that I think civil rights for Muslims is, you know, we're not in the best shape, and, you know, there's a bunch of black eyes and all sorts of conversations we could have a whole podcast series just devoted to. But
you said black eyes.
Yes. Not black guys.
Right. I was like, wait, black guys? Like, looks like you need some food. Yes.
Sorry.
Racist.
No, I meant the black eye. Yeah,
right.
Okay.
Good thing it's not the winter, otherwise it'd be black ice. Right.
So with things, you know, with the Muslim ban and with all the, you know, stuff that you know what I'm talking about, I think that at the end of the day, this country gets it right. I believe that. I think that in time, we, you know, we push through, and it goes back to, you know, the will of the people. And I, you know, it's those of us whose job for a living, what we do is kind of deal with the battle of hearts and minds, and I hope that there's headway with one step forward and even three or four step backwards, that in time we will see a Muslim in the in the highest office of the United States.
So let me just say, I mean, so right now, I wanted Abdul El-Sayed to be on, but obviously he's running for governor of Michigan right now, and I've had some conversations with a few people, and you know, they're surprised that he's running for governor rather than trying to be in somebody else's administration. A lot of promise, but probably not ready for office. But we have a president who is also not qualified for the office that he holds. So,
but couldn't have been in anybody else's administration.
But being qualified, yeah, being qualified is apparently not a qualifier anymore. Mm. So, but my thought is when he announced his candidacy, my first thought was not, oh wow, you know, I know he did some good stuff in the Duggan administration, but I don't think that he's ready. I don't think he has enough. Experience under his belt yet. Far more than I do, but I don't think he does. That was not my first thought. I was like, there's no way he's winning in Michigan. There's 0% chance of a guy with that name winning in this state, period. You know, full stop. Even with the presence of Dearborn, Michigan, I don't think that he wins. So
he's got to win Grand Rapids, got to win the UP.
And so, probably not going to happen. No, but
right, yeah.
All based on name. All based on the fact that that is an Arabic name. That guy is clearly a Muslim. Doesn't hide it. I liked the way that he had his announcement rally at Eastern Market, where he had, you know, Christians praying, Muslims praying. So I mean, it was very inclusive. But I still just thought, nope. People are going to look at that and go, not going to vote for him. I would hear his platform, and if I felt he was the best out of all the people, I would vote for him. But I don't think that he would win. And that's a sad reality. I could be wrong. I could be very wrong.
Yeah.
You know, Rozzy's giving me like this wry smile right now. So what do you have to say to that?
Well, I mean, unlikelier things have happened, and let's
true
not
story.
Forget that Barack
like in November.
Obama. Yeah, right. And let's not forget Barack Obama shares a middle name with a former deposed dictator of Iraq, and so you know, I think if it's possible for America and this climate to elect an African-American president, you know, despite the forces against the likelihood of something like that happening, I think there's a possibility. Certainly there's a possibility.
Isn't it just by virtue of arithmetic much harder, because black people in America are stable at between 12-13% of our population, but Muslims are 2%?
Well, numbers. I mean, any group has to form a coalition. I don't really see that as a problem. And contrary to what Fatina might think, I'm not so lacking in sanguinity about this. But I will say that, because as a historian, we sort of are consigned to looking at things on the long arc. I'm not really sure if it's going to happen within the next 2 generations.
Okay.
I'm not to say that it would never happen. But given where the current discourse is, and given where the country is going as it moves toward becoming a majority-minority country within a generation, and as Kent pointed out, given the relatively small population of Muslims, and even if it wasn't for the small population, just the narrative about them, I think that's going to have to be something to push to a different time. But at the same time, it doesn't have to be about who holds the highest office. In fact, if anything, there's an opportunity to go for building from a foundational level lower offices, which are very important, developing the relations that are required, developing the cultural literacy. And I think the point about the gubernatorial race, I will say from an Islamic standpoint, from an Islamic ethical standpoint, my ethics of Islam tell me that you build up, that there is something fundamentally wrong with assuming or presuming that you have an entitlement to go for the brass ring in the beginning. If you take a look at Islamic history, for example, the Prophet built up a Muslim state.
I do wonder, though, about the presence of Muslims in the political process as well, because I mean, beyond the voting, but actually being a name on the ballot. Because I'm looking at, you know, the Senate, you know, senators. We have no Muslim senators. We do have a few congressmen, but I look back at the words of Thomas Jefferson talking about Muslims. So Muslims have been in this country for a very, very, very long time. Hmm. I'm wondering, is there an impetus within, again, I know Muslims are not a monolith, but is there anything that keeps Muslims out of being on the ballot to the degree that they've been here as long as this country has been a country, and there are not many people holding many political offices that I'm aware of?
So I think there's an interesting thing about the demographics of the Muslim community. I mean, you're looking at the two main groups, say African-American and immigrant. Immigrant Muslims are coming from places where political enfranchisement is not that easy, if at all possible. Mm. You also have an African-American community who literally was forged in the crucible of the whole civil rights saga. And so you're looking at two groups which have been historically politically disenfranchised. So they are now getting into that process. So there's a learning curve that's involved, and there's a matter of, do you do a cannonball into the swimming pool, or do you edge your way into the pool? And I think we're finding now, and particularly with the Obama era, that there is a heightened sense of motivation and to be enfranchised. And I think that the example of the gubernatorial race is one such example. But at the same time, take a look at the last religious minority that went for it, John F. Kennedy. Before Kennedy even thought about running, he himself was a senator, he was a congressman, and there were plenty of Catholics in government at the local state and the national level.
I thought a Mormon was the last one to really go for it.
Well, the one who succeeded. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
Well, I think that, definitely to that point, you know, Keith Ellison, I heard him talk once, and people were asking, you know, actually when he was running for DNC chair, you know, do you think being Muslim is going to be like a really big challenge for you? You know, is that what people are going to paint you as? And what he was saying was that, you know, for me, when I was trying to win my congressional seat, I wasn't saying, telling people I'm the Muslim candidate, you know, going around just touting the fact that I'm Muslim. Like, I don't hide my faith or anything, but he was saying that he focuses on making sure that he is trying to solve people's problems and telling them like how he's going to solve their problems and standing for the issues that they care about. So I think also, you know, to what you guys were saying before about John F. Kennedy, right? He was all of these other things. I think for a Muslim to succeed at a high state level office or the national office, they're going to have so many other associations with them, rather than just, you know, to be easily painted as a Muslim and have that be the only overarching association that stands out. I mean, like, you know, essentially we have to have like someone who's a congressman or a senator where they're like, oh, okay, this person, they know what they're doing. Or even honestly, maybe even a Muslim celebrity, who someone who's like, you know, really liked and admired for not their religion, and the religion is just a small part of their story. You know, like if Dr. Oz randomly wanted to run for president, right? I mean, people would be talking a lot less about the fact that he's Muslim than the fact that he's Dr. Oz and like became famous because of Oprah and all that.
Dead serious. I mean, Dr. Oz is Muslim?
Yep.
Didn't know.
Yeah, Dr. Oz is
Muslim. Turkish.
I want to take this back quickly.
See, right?
Yeah.
Solomon.
Like, nobody even knows that he's Muslim.
If I can, yeah. If I can just take us back quickly to my optimism to defend it and to show that it's not just naive, you know, because I have little kids that just keep me optimistic about life and possibilities. I think what we see here is a series of trends that I'm hoping when they all come together, I don't know if I'd put it as one generation or two generations out, but we have a series of shifts here going on here. One is kind of what Syed had referenced in terms of just cultural competency overall. So where Muslim leadership from the top, from the bottom, grassroots going up and top down is really shifting towards using the faith itself as a mechanism to encourage people to participate in the political process. We had not seen this necessarily for a long time before. So Friday prayers, ideas even of who is the recipient of alms and who is should fall right into the folds of religious charity are now people and places of advocacy, for instance. It's no longer just kind of the proverbial, you know, bread and you know, you feed people. It's we're building institutions, growing in terms of even the idea of having data about our own community, from our own community is kind of part of that. So I think a combination of the shift from the Muslim community itself, with this kind of attack that we feel like we're under in terms of the narrative that Saeed referenced, that's not pretty, that's for sure. But I think it's that energy that comes from that ugly narrative combined with, you know, three generations of folks. I can tell you, you know, I was in college during 9/11, and 80% of us switched gear from going to medical school or engineering that were kind of safe spaces and safe professions for kids of immigrants to law and journalism and politics. And this had not happened. And now we're 15 years out, and you look at the Muslim schools and you look at the mosques, and there is a push for voter participation on one level to running for office. Give us some candidates, pooling resources and money. And I think areas that maybe other communities either take for granted or can't even remember a time where they had been so new and young at doing this, our community continues to be that. But I think it's growing at an incredibly great pace, and that with optimism and depending on who the candidate is, I think you get the right kind of a person on the ballot. I don't care if his name is Muhammad. If he checks all the other boxes, voters are going to put him to task on that faith the way they have other candidates. But the idea is that people will see past it when and if they should.
Okay. Well, I think that's a good place to break. We're going to take about a 5 to 7 minute break here, and we will be back. Well, hey, everybody, thanks so much for waiting on the line. We're going to dive right back into questions. The second segment, we're going to talk more about some of the more divisive political issues where people of the Muslim faith tend to come up. So the question I want to ask here is, okay, so what are political issues to consider for Muslim communities when specifically addressing fears of terrorism or actual terrorist attacks? I mean, just last week you had Kabul, a bombing happened in Kabul. Then you had the attack on the London Bridge. It seems like every few days you're hearing an escalation, some sort of terrorist attack that is attributed to Muslims. Obviously, there's gun violence here in the United States. There's mass shootings that happen in the United States. But I don't know that they either get the coverage or are happening at the same scale of terrorist organizations in the name of the Muslim faith are doing things. Or saying it's in the name of the Muslim faith, and it may not be. But I know we hear that's not Islam. That's fine. I know there are Christian, you know, people who say they're Christian groups, and I can say they're not Christian. That's fine. That's on the table. That's in bounds. But it still has to affect you politically. There are things that you have to think about. There are things that I think everybody at this table said, well, 9/11 did, and all of you would say, those aren't Muslims, right? That's a bastardization of what our faith is. But you still all had to think about 9/11 was what I'm saying.
No. So, that's such a great point. This is a debate that's been going on really since 9/11 about apologetics, framing of the issue. Mm-hmm. You see this with ISIS. Are they Muslim? Are they not Muslim? Mm. It's kind of hard to go ahead and say that they're not Muslim or that this doesn't have anything to do with Islam when they themselves are proclaiming it. It may be a full bastardization, but it still comes under this rather broad umbrella.
Okay.
That is Islam or Islamicate.
Well, I guess the question is whether you accept them as you know, in the faith or outside of the faith through their acts.
We
you have to think about this politically.
We don't have the luxury of excommunication.
Okay.
And that, I think, has a lot to do. And I think one of the challenges that I find with what is going on right now with the Muslim community is how much we're going to sort of mutate the definition of Islam in order to fit a politically acceptable narrative. So you hear people out of a sense of self-preservation and survival. I mean, look, I mean, these are sort of the low ends of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Mm-hmm. I mean, but the idea that people will go ahead and reflexively say, you know, that's not Islam or this is not Islam or what have you. My fear is the long-term impact of that, that is it going to be an Islam that is then recognizable, that is authentic, that takes into account its entire history, its interpretation, bad and good, by Muslims. That's something that will then affect the political perspective of Muslims as well because of how they negotiate this issue. But to, the point, though, is surveillance, civil liberties. I mean, these are the big political issues that always affect Muslims when an attack happens. What is going to be taken away from not just Muslims, but let's face it, when these things come in, they're never against just Muslims. The, you mentioned the terrorist attack in London of a few days ago. Prime Minister Theresa May, who may be fighting for her political life with the elections coming up tomorrow, one of her messages was that maybe we should consider restricting the internet. Well, who else restricts the internet? Gulf states and China, as well as North Korea. So what does that really mean? Muslims in many ways have become the canaries in the coal mine, that what is being thought of done to Muslims is going to affect broader American society as well.
I think in terms of this kind of real fear that, that folks in the Muslim community have about this tendency, I think Saeed is right about kind of survival to knee-jerk reaction to say, Islam is never violent. Islam has always been peaceful. Islam is all about giving and loving. It's not, and it hasn't always been. And if having a, you know, sophisticated, complicated, real conversation about that is not the time, perhaps, when it's really a question I get all the time, you know. So when there's a terrorist attack, Muslim leaders, say, let's say in Southeast Michigan, convene sometimes, and they say, should we go out right away and condemn it first and then apologize and then get to who we really are and explain it away? I mean, we're really kind of we're stuck in grappling. Some are of the opinion that, I mean, why would we apologize? Not because we are not apologetic of what happened, but because it should be such a given that any human being is disgusted by the mayhem and what has occurred and by the ugliness and the bloodshed, that it should go beyond, it should go without saying, and that by saying it, there's somehow this assumption that we need to say it because we would otherwise not be so sympathetic to, you know, dead children and blood and bodies. But the flip is, in oversimplifying, you know, Islam is entirely peaceful, for instance. Islam has never been about any type of war. It first of all, it's not true. And along the way, you just kind of get into the other end of the spectrum of just glossing over 1,500 years of a very sophisticated, rich tradition that has grappled and dealt with all the existential questions of human life, which some of them have not been so perfect in the result, but some of them have been fantastically tolerant and diverse and rich and pluralistic and led, you know, the world and civilizations in a number of key ways that both Muslims and non-Muslims alike view as such a, you know, distant past that we almost can't remember to reach into that arsenal of success stories because we're so busy kind of dodging and ducking and dealing with, you know, the junk we have today.
Do you really want to use the word arsenal with success stories?
Yeah, that's the thing. Just careful. We're laughing about it, but any conversation, I mean, except perhaps by intellectuals who sometimes get more leeway in being better about parameters of conversations. You know, this idea that Islamic history has always been perfect. It's had several blemishes, but, you know, not to compare sufferings or to compare, you know, blemishes, but what part of religious histories and civilizations have been so perfect that, you know, its adherents don't want to duck or dodge parts of it and are shameful and ashamed of parts of the past? And that's what religious traditions are. They're lived, they're living, they're developed, they're developing. And Muslims and Muslim communities are no different.
And I'm very happy that with your candor, both of your candor on this question, obviously. Razi and Solomon, I want you both to have chances to weigh in on this as well. But I think, Saeed, you and I have had a lot of conversations offline. Both you and I and you as well, Fatina, have backgrounds in religion. You know, I have a degree in theology. I have 4 degrees in theology at this point. You've got degrees in theology as well, and you teach. And I find it hard to talk to, within Christian circles, what I would like to call the hoi polloi, right? You know, okay. Teaching religion, want to teach people, you need to be humble, but it's really hard. I feel like I went to school to be a doctor and I get out and I'm like, Mr. and so, you know, Mr. Mrs. So-and-so, you have cancer. Well, you know, I got this article on Wikipedia, and it says that I actually just have a tummy ache. I'm like, well, you know, no. I went to school for this. I understand what, you know, the ins and outs of this kind of stuff. And there's a little bit more honesty when you have to deal with the fact that, hey, the story of Noah's Ark, it's not just about a floating zoo. It's about mass xenocide, you know, like God killing everybody. How do you deal with these kinds of things? But I find when I talk with Christians, it's very simplistic conversations. But also when I talk with Muslims about things, I feel like you've said some of the same stuff. It's very hard to talk to a person with a very basic understanding of Islam who's going to say something like, you know, Islam doesn't have that history. Islam is only a religion of peace. I think this is a question that I asked you 10 years ago. You know, is religion, you know, is Islam a religion of war or peace? And you said both. It is both. And that floored me at the time because I was trying to, like, back you into the corner as this, you know, evangelical Christian student.
You can't, push baby into the corner.
Yeah, but it's not the answer that you get. And so I'm loving the candor because it the way that you're also answering the question disallows me from and other people from going, well, see, this is all. I mean, you're going, hey, this is religion in general. This is what they look like. This is how they get to where they are. This is our dark spots. You have your dark spots. And you did it without saying, well, you know, what about the Crusades and the Christians? And what about, you know, the Buddhists doing this? You said, this is our mess. We know we've got it. It's part of our mess. Then it's part of our mess now, and we've got to deal with it in different ways. And I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you. And I think it's also important to recognize that's also part of the Islamic ethos to be that honest and candid. I mean, that's the place that we're coming from, if I may.
The irony, and thanks for the compliment. We rarely get complimented for being honest and frank, and I use words like arsenal and jihad all at once.
Well, using the word arsenal with a Manchester United fan is always murky.
I was going to bring that up, but I thought it was a little geeky. I was like,
But the truth is, it is, ironically, to be true to the tradition, to engage the tradition, is to be frank with it and to embrace it all and deal with it all with all its, you know, glory and guts, I guess, to use another war term, guts. But, I mean, I think in also doing it, aside from the fact that it's kind of the intellectually and morally consistent thing to do, is to, on the one hand, for Muslims to kind of ward off attacks of, you know, we started out by saying, we're not on a monolith and don't oversimplify and don't stereotype, et cetera, et cetera. Similarly, when it suits us, we can't just because it could suit us to say it's entirely a peaceful religion. You know, act like I'm giving a talk to Muslims in front of me, but I'm not. But we're still a religion of principles and a religion of accountability. To account, we're accountable. So the transparency, I think, that and the consistency that we're seeking in terms of being 2% of this country and being treated well as citizens, we would expect of ourselves and to ourselves. At least I could speak for myself. And
okay. Rosie Solomon.
Yeah, so I...
no, go ahead.
So I would say that there's two segments of things to sort of think about when it comes to political issues that Muslims should consider when addressing fears of terrorism. On the one side, Muslims feel a sense of duty and responsibility to disavow any connections to these individuals and these characters and these agents that are playing a role in committing these acts. And then the other part of it are the true implications of political policy that takes place in the form of in the form of Islamophobic policies. So whether it's surveillance, whether it's the immigration bans that have been enacted recently, these things don't just affect Muslims. They can and will end up affecting other disenfranchised minority communities. And so these are things that everyone has to think about as well. Those are just a couple of points that I wanted to make. You know, Muslims feel a sense of responsibility in sort of distancing themselves from these individuals and then also having to think about the very real implications of any policy changes that could take place as well. Those are very real threats.
Okay.
Yeah.
Solomon.
Yeah. So ultimately, for me, I think that, you know, when I see all this crazy stuff that terrorists are doing and that ISIS is doing, I mean, I'm not a religious scholar. I don't have degrees in like religion or Islam. I mean, I have just kind of my grown up understanding of what it means for me and my family to be Muslim. And for me, that is 100% against, you know, what the heck these crazy people are doing, you know? So, I mean, although I do think it's important for us to be, to have like qualified, answers and like a more nuanced understanding of like our tradition and our religion and understanding that all religions do have violent moments. Like for me, this is 100%. When I think of that, it's like, that is not Islam. And, you know, I saw this quote the other day that was like, if you can differentiate between the KKK and Christians, then you can differentiate between ISIS and Islam. And like,
I actually posted that.
I'm sorry?
I actually posted that on my wall the other day. Thank you. It's pretty cool.
I know. It's so great. And like, but the thing is, that is not the prevailing narrative, which is why it's really, when you hear about terrorist attacks, first of all, your heart goes out to all those families that have to deal with this ridiculous, unimaginable suffering. But then as a Muslim, you also have to think, you end up ultimately thinking about how this is just going to play into the narrative that Muslims are crazy who and just want to like kill everybody. You know, and like kill the Western world. And that's, of course, like the most simplistic understanding, but that's many people's understanding when they're not really thinking about this all that much because they've got their own lives and they're just flipping through the TV and they see another terrorist attack. And, you know, my friend, one of my friends in college, he's a black guy, and he said, and like we were in a social justice class, and he was talking about how whenever, you know, on the local news, you know, there was, he grew up in like more of an urban area where there was crime. And then whenever he saw that there was a, you know, a murder or rape or anything like that, when they were identifying the person who perpetrated that crime, he was just hoping that that person wasn't black because it was just playing into this narrative that, oh yeah, look, this is what black people do. And honestly, I know a lot of Muslim people feel a very similar way when we hear about a mass shooting or we hear about a terrorist attack. And you're like, okay, please let this just be some psycho person who's not Muslim, who didn't just yell Allahu Akbar at the end of their mass slaughter before they got killed. You know, so, I mean, it, like, for me, and I think for most Muslim people who are not scholars, like, we are, when we hear about this stuff, it's like, that is disgusting, that is not Islam, and there's not really any gray area there.
I wonder if
you know, and I think there absolutely needs to not be for many people in order to actually like be part of the faith.
I wonder if there is a, and we've done episodes on white privilege, but I wonder if there is a sort of white Christian privilege when it comes to certain things, because I don't think there is a, I don't think when a mass shooting happens that white people freak out. Like, oh my God, I hope to God that it wasn't a white Christian male.
Sure.
That doesn't happen that I'm aware of.
Yeah, absolutely not. Like, I've never, no. I'm sure that doesn't happen.
And so
also churches don't get monitored and surveilled, you know, when this happens as well.
True.
So what I was alluding to earlier about these policy concerns,
mm-hmm.
You know, when a Christian-inspired terrorist commits an act of terrorism, mm-hmm. You know, then the entire community does not become a subject to that surveillance.
Right.
Yeah.
And I do wonder, okay, so earlier at the beginning of this question, Saeed, you said, you know, we don't have the luxury of excommunication. And I don't know if you were saying that religiously or if you were saying that perceptually in terms of, you know, if a Muslim did it, we just think all Muslims did it, right? Or if there is something within the Quran and the Hadith that says, you know,
I meant it theologically. I mean,
okay,
like right now there's
because we can't. Like I can look at a Jonestown. I could say that's not Christian.
Yeah.
I can look at who's the guy who God hates fags. That guy.
Westboro Baptist Church.
Yeah. I can look at that and go that's not Christianity. I can look at a person who blows up an abortion, you know, clinic and be like, well, you know, while I'm against abortion, that's not Christian to do that, right? And so
okay,
we can do that.
But you switched. I mean, you said that's not Christian to do that versus that's not Christianity.
Not Christian, yeah.
So, I mean, we grapple with those situations.
I meant the same
well.
Thing. I just...
Sure. But, I mean, Muslims tend to be very, very cautious about going ahead and branding somebody to be an apostate or to not be a Muslim because that is left up to God. And... You know, back to that point about how this is mutating Muslims. Right now, the London attackers,
mm-hmm.
130 or so Muslim clerics in England signed a pledge saying we will not bury them. We will not preside over their funeral. That's a fairly strong statement that they're making, but it seems as though that's more of a political statement. Mm-hmm. I mean, this becomes that whole idea that if a rapist and his victim both come into the emergency room and they're both wounded, as a doctor, you don't have the moral license to go ahead and say that I can't treat one and I will treat the other. Mm-hmm. So I think that these are issues that have to be also raised from within a theological standpoint. Now, Rezi, you mentioned the thing about churches being surveilled. And I think this is also an important point. Today, mosques are being surveilled because on religious grounds, but Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s church was surveilled by J. Edgar Hoover, yeah. And that was a racial thing. So I think that we do have something within our history in this country of that.
Okay.
So America has got a generalized fear about Sharia law in America, especially among political and religious conservatives. What is your understanding of Sharia, and is it a concern for you?
And I know, actually, I'd like you to answer this question first, Fatina, because you taught a class on Sharia law at Wayne State Law, if I'm not mistaken. So I want to call you the expert in the room at the moment. What is Sharia law? Can you define that for our listeners? And are concerns valid?
Yeah, I mean, so a couple of things. Sharia law is not getting set up in Wayne County here, right? There's no black flag being put into the grass of the Coleman Young court building, and the fourth floor is not going to be swapped out from, you know, the family court or civil court division to Sharia law. I mean, I kind of joke about that, but if you look at the pulse of some of these anti-Sharia law movements, and they're really movements, there'll be a local community where there's, first of all, not even a Muslim within, you know, 40 square miles, you know, any 40 miles any direction. And there'll be full-fledged legislation passed, you know, proposed and passed to make sure that Sharia law is not in, you know, community, just, for example, Alabama, anywhere.
Which is kind of like outlawing the force.
it is, except that it's not always, you know, that funny, but it's not that funny because we aren't necessarily willing to meet a Muslim or learn about a Muslim, but, you know, the term Sharia law is like common parlance in people's, you know, conversations. People can say it almost enunciate it correctly. So there's this willingness to become comfortable with Muslims in terms of their misunderstanding of Sharia law, but there's not a willingness to really actually understand Sharia law, if that makes sense. And the two are just at odds with each other, and it creates a big mess. So I am a licensed attorney in the state of Michigan, and we don't practice Sharia law here. I'm being kind of funny, but there are a lot of people, and then I ask students, and, you know, sometimes you have the fortunate position to talk to people, you know, off the record and just get their real sense. People really believe there's this force that Muslims are going to take over the United States somehow. The Constitution is going to get tossed out the window. The laws as we know them are gone, and Sharia law is going to just prevail. And I guess
what
it wasn't
it,
an answer to your question, but there's just very much that overview.
Well, if I'm sorry. I'm going to have to go ahead and just maybe I'm a little bit punchy. I'm going to go ahead and be provocative here. I'm going to say that Sharia is here, and it's actually U.S. law. And the reason I frame it like that is – I know, exactly. You know, here come the gongs. is because the law of the land is completely compatible with what Muslims would want. Hmm. So that's really not an issue. Muslims are not sitting here conflicted saying, oh, my God, I can only drive 70 miles an hour. Sharia says I can drive 80. that's not how it is. Where the debate really is about accommodation. And essentially what we're finding now is people don't want Muslims to get the same kind of accommodations that other religions have. When I moved to the United States from England, I was 8 years old. I was appalled by how homogenous the lunch menu was in the cafeterias of school on Fridays. It was two things which were immutable on the menu.
Fish
sandwiches and macaroni and cheese. Do most people know that that was in order to accommodate Catholics for Meatless Friday?
Mm.
In New York State, for example, the Jewish community is allowed to negotiate their own divorces. It's called a get. And the get is then recognized by the American courts. So we have had a long history of accommodations for various religious communities. The Muslim community now is simply in a similar situation where they're availing themselves of the same political and civic engagement that others have as well.
Okay. Why? I threw this question out to Facebook. I like to do this each week, take one of the questions that we're asking and put it out to see what people think, just get a cross-section of ideas. It's kind of interesting what came back. Wendy Williams said, I am not the least bit worried about Sharia law in America. My friend Melissa Matkovich said, I don't know anything about it, but I will tell you I'm more concerned about religious doctrine, Christianity, taking over policy because it's a real threat. Will Blattman says, I have no real understanding of it, and I'm not concerned about it. Annalise Constantino said, I have a general understanding of it, a major key point being that of all legal systems in the world today, Sharia law is the most intrusive and restrictive, especially against women. It permits and even encourages abusive and demeaning behavior toward women. I am not terribly concerned, however, with it becoming the norm in this country. That led to a huge debate.
That's not a generalization.
Brandon Carolyn said, non-Muslims in Dearborn aren't afraid of it becoming a reality. That should tell you something. Once you get to know these people, you realize there aren't enough extremists among them to exact any real change. There are, however, enough Christian extremists to worry about here. And the list goes on and on and on of people saying no concerns about Sharia. But that hasn't – and more concerns with Christian extremism than anything else. But that doesn't answer the question. Earlier you said, you know, they can pronounce it. What is it? Yeah. I don't know what it is.
So I did earlier what I ended up doing during my whole semester, so I've been spending several weeks describing what it's not, and then you finally get around to getting what it is. But I think this speaks to the whole climate of misunderstanding about religion, about Muslims, rather. Sometimes before we can get into affirmatively who we are or what we believe or where we're headed, we have to unpack what it's not, unfortunately, gotcha. Deconstructing. But so cites that Sharia law is living and breathing, you know, here. I was distancing from this kind of otherwise stereotypical idea that there's a black flag, you know, going to be inserted somewhere in one of the courts in Wayne County. But you get the point. Do Muslims in America, do I practice Sharia law? Yes. I mean, on a daily basis, do I use the Sharia law, which is the developed religious framework for how a Muslim should live their life? So it is a combination of the theological disposition with the application to a person's life. So I choose to pray, and therefore I'm following Sharia law. The specifics with how I pray and the mode in which I do it would be my engagement with Sharia law. If one is fasting, they're abiding by Sharia law. And I think that, you know, again, this goes back to kind of the Muslim-American strategy. To either apologize and deny, or to really, you know, kind of admit and to deal with the fact that, and to embrace and be appreciative and American about the fact that we are allowed to practice our religion in this country, and that Muslims do, and that there's nothing incongruent with practicing Sharia law by virtue of choosing to give alms and to pray and to fast and to help the poor. All of these are aspects of the law called Sharia law that has been developed over about 1600 years. So it depends on, you know, what part of the law you're following. It's a very rich.
Now, I know a little bit about it. I know that there is, I believe, only one country in the world that actually has it as the official part of their constitution. There are other countries that have made some accommodations where it's more a cultural laws that
is it Iran?
Muslims say, no.
Is it Iran?
that Muslims,
what's the one country?
I believe that it's Iran.
That's what I said. Is it Iran?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I thought you said is it Israel. I was like,
no.
That didn't sound anything like Iran.
Nope.
But either way, I was seeing there were accommodations made in certain European countries where if there are some cultural issues within the Muslim community, they can take care of it themselves. And when I was researching, this was several weeks ago, I, you know, as someone who has, you know, majored in Christian theology, I see within Christian theology, within the New Testament, within Pauline theology, they talk about essentially the same thing. If that's a tenet of Sharia law, there is precedence in Scripture where it says you shouldn't be suing one another and taking this to the courts. You should take care of this yourselves within the Christian community. And that is when I was reading, you know, the accommodations that are made within, you know, places like London. Okay, there are dispensations for small communities of Muslims to take care of cultural issues. But let's say a murder happened. Well, that's now being taken care of in London courts, right? You know, and so hey, you know, you have a dispute between each other over, you know, charging in, you know, what do you call it?
Usury.
Yeah, usury. Those kinds of things can be taken care of within your community. That's fine. But high crimes, misdemeanors, that's obviously you're under the same law that everybody else is under. I see that within Christianity based on things that it said there. Now, I don't see Christians really practice it. Christians pretty much abdicated everything to government control in a way. But I do see the precedent there. And so if we have it, I don't understand why so many conservative Christians are afraid of Muslims having a similar thing.
Well, part of that then becomes a matter of it becomes a matter of social control. Right. This is one of the ways that then people have leverage over other communities, particularly when they are minority communities. Now, this whole system that you're talking about actually existed in world history, and it existed under the Ottoman Turkish Muslims. The Ottoman Empire had what was called a millet system, where every religious community, the minorities, were given the authority from the Sultan to select their own religious leaders and to have authority over their own religious matters. That way that the Ottoman Sultan or the bureaucracy in Istanbul was not going to decide for you when was Yom Kippur or the high holidays. It was not going to decide when was Easter or how do you bury a body or a ruling on the sacrament or the Eucharist.
Rome did that with the Jews. I mean, same thing, right?
Yeah. Okay. So, but here you've got a far more diverse empire when it comes to not only interfaith diversity, but also intrafaith diversity. And it worked until nationalism came in and European powers from the outside exploited these ethnic communities from within and said, hey, we're going to help you break off into your own nation state. And then you see the dismantling of the Ottoman Empire. It is certainly a theory that could find its way into a law journal article. It would probably be seen as very provocative because, of course, it would dismantle what we understand as the separation of church and state.
Okay. I think the issue that we are missing is the difference between Sharia law and what Bubba from Murfreesboro, Tennessee, thinks it is. And he thinks it's honor killing. And because every so often there'll be a father or a brother who kills a woman for sexual immorality, and it is backed up by some Quranic text. So people see that and they say, oh, that's Sharia law.
Yeah, but the honor killing is not something that is permitted by the state. It is then seen as a crime in, say, a country like Pakistan. It is not given sanction. So I think there's the importance of seeing when the individual claims that it's an act of Sharia, which at that point it's an ethical issue,
versus
whether the state that does it, which becomes a legal issue. So here's another moment of candor. So as you called him, was it Bubba?
Bubba from Murfreesboro.
Yes. Bubba from Murfreesboro. Okay. First time caller, long time listener.
That one. Yes.
So,
you're on the air, Bubba.
So Bubba from Murfreesboro, Tennessee. For him, the lens of Sharia is capital punishment, beheadings, hand amputations. For the Muslim, Sharia means dietary regulation, how to pray, rituals, and ethics. Here's the kicker. Bubba's right, and so is the Muslim, because that is how broad Sharia is. And the problem is that we're talking past one another. Mm-hmm. There is no common ground upon which Sharia can be discussed, because he has essentialized Sharia as being a violent thing, especially if it were imposed on everybody else. And the Muslim is simply focused on him or herself and him or her, his or her community, to really be concerned about things that they're never going to engage in.
And to be frank about Bubba's concerns here, you know, in terms of the criminal code, right? This idea that Sharia law has a very harsh criminal code as it relates to, you know, how it would sanction certain criminal conduct. The only, I guess, parallel or analogy is otherwise archaic, you know, penal punishments that we've seen and not too long ago, you know, mm-hmm. That one hopes with time and engagement either get, you know, written off the books or they stay on the books, like all kinds of laws we have in this country that are not so, you know, liberal and not so fair, but that don't ever get implemented. So there are archaic laws that are there that are very real. But again, with absent a state to implement those criminal laws, because a believing Muslim worrying about prayer and worrying about their dietary restriction didn't even get to the book of Sharia law that deals with the penal code because it's not a state to implement those penal measures. So Baba may know a thing or two more about Sharia law criminal code more than, you know, the Muslim living in Dearborn would have no interest to engage the criminal penal code aspect of Sharia law that is on volume, you know, volume 38, page 802, footnote, whatever, because it's so archaic and outdated. So is Baba's concern true about the ugliness of the penal code? Yes. Is the penal code living and breathing and applicable to Baba or to, you know, the Muslim living in Dearborn? No.
And the other thing is, I mean, maybe Bubba has a little case of penal code envy because maybe there's some parts in the Sharia that
see what you did there.
Implemented.
I see what you did there.
Up top. So then I want to move it on because, so the Muslim in Dearborn might not have the concern, but Bubba, for his case study, is going to point to a country like Iran where this is the law of the land, right? And so where there is a state to enforce this kind of thing and where it has not turned out so well for many of its citizens. So then a common refrain is that Muslims in the West think very differently about America than their counterparts in the Middle East. Western Muslims are said to want to assimilate. We just want to have, you know, the American dream just like everybody else, while Muslims in the East are opposed to Western imperialism and some say they hate democracy. They hate freedom, right? As one person commented, I just read this in a book yesterday, when the Americans came, he's quoting he says jihadist, so he's a conservative writer, but he said, when the Americans came, they stepped on our heads with their shoes, which I guess is a very insulting thing to be under the soles of someone's shoe, which he said when they slapped the Saddam Hussein statue was with the shoe and they threw a shoe at George Bush. So apparently that's a big no-no. Do you believe those characterizations? Are those characterizations accurate? Do American Muslims think differently than Muslims in the Middle East about America?
So I want to say that, you know, if Muslims in America thought all that much differently than Muslims out in the Middle East or from Asia, then why would Muslims from those places be immigrating to America?
That's a question I have. But this.
I'm sorry?
I think that's a valid question. However, this narrative somehow persists. Like, obviously,
persists because that is what is being espoused by people who are really anti-Muslim in their rhetoric, you know, in their policies, who just want to fearmonger for their political points. But, I mean, if you look at the people who come here, like my family, like many other families, they came here, they gave up so much because they believed and were excited about the American dream. And people would really do anything to come here because they want what is promised them, because they want freedom. They want the ability to work hard and be able to provide for their family. Ultimately, everyone kind of just wants the same thing. And that's why people are trying so hard to get here. And when they get here, in my family and the families that I talk to, they can never imagine ever going back, even though they came just like 5, 10, 15 years ago, because it's not everything that they had imagined, but a lot of times it does fulfill some of the promises for the reason why they came here. So, I mean, so for people to want to come here, right, there needs to be kind of that sentiment already in those areas where people want this kind of stuff.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, part of the problem that I have with a question like this is
I freely admit I might be asking the wrong question. So.
Sure, it's a perpetual reinforcement of this idea that Muslims are foreigners, or that Muslims are the other. Even at what
said,
point?
Three generations you've been here already? That kind
of
thing.
Well, yeah, you know, I talk to in my work as a documentarian. I you know, work with a lot of people in Hamtramck and a lot of, you know, and so recently I've started referring to suburban Muslims as suburban Muslims of immigrant heritage. You know, I think it's a much more accurate way to describe the community. And so we talk about African-American Muslims or suburban Muslims or Muslims of immigrant heritage. And so after three or four...
Or you could just say Muslims of suburban heritage. Or Muslims that's becoming a phenomenon.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, and they're privy to and precluded from the same challenges and issues that anybody else's, you know. So the premise of the question is a little bit, it just bothers me a little bit, you know, when we talk about Muslims in America versus Muslims abroad. Well, there's huge differences, you know, and there's reasons that are obvious why Muslims in America think differently. And then there's reasons that are subtle. There's sociopolitical and economic reasons for why that is as well. And I think that a lot of what this question is alluding to, that that somehow American Muslims have favorable views of the United States, I think what the question is alluding to is that Muslim of immigrant heritage community, which tends to be prosperous, which tends to be educated, which tends to be on the upward path of economic mobility. Now, when you talk to African-American Muslims, what are their views of America? And those views are going to be much more similar to views of the larger African-American landscape or the larger African-American opinions in the United States. So I just wanted to lay that groundwork a little bit before we get into this question.
Well, I mean, even in America, there's such a cultural difference between the city folk, the suburban folk, the exurban folk, the rural folk.
Yeah.
I mean, people who live in New York City think that we are just a bunch of hayseeds out here, even though we live in Detroit.
Sure.
And people in Detroit might feel the same way about people from, say, Bad Axe in the Thumb. I mean, when it comes to people who are overseas, and I mean, I travel so much for my work, and I'm very fortunate to be able to do this. I talk to the very wealthy in Dubai or in Pakistan or something, and if you ask them, hey, you want to come to America? They're like, oh, hell no.
Yeah.
Because they run the place. They own the place. For them, it's a matter of utter privilege.
Yeah.
So when it comes to those who are considering migration, it's usually that there is some kind of a disruption or that there's a deficiency in the status quo.
Hmm.
And what they may be seeking is more political stability, more economic stability, but there's an opportunity cost because they're also probably coming into a place that has more cultural fluidity.
Hmm.
So these negotiations and contestations are happening all the time by Muslims. And those are the ones who have a certain level of voluntariness. Hmm. We're not even going to get into the issue about the poor refugees.
Sure.
For them to have to make that decision, usually because other people have made the circumstances, they've made the decision for them.
That'll probably be the next panel that we do.
Ah, okay.
So what are some concrete ways that the Muslim community is attempting to reach across the aisle, both politically and religiously? And we'll wrap up with this.
I guess I can start. I talked a bit about it in terms of the reasons for my optimism, ultimately, that we can and will hopefully, not sure how soon, but see Muslims in positions of high office, maybe one time soon, in the highest office of the land. You see, again, generationally, reaching across the aisle by virtue of simply shifting gears out of certain otherwise safe professions. I say that, again, it's very important that for immigrant Muslims who came from places of political instability, I can speak, for instance, about children of Arab immigrants who came from places where people in charge weren't so nice and you didn't, you know, mess around with politics and you didn't say the wrong things and you never rocked any boat ever. You came to America to get a good job and to bust your behind and work as hard as you could and needed to send your kids to good schools, who then became nice Muslim boys and girls who became engineers and doctors. And that's what you see in terms of a whole generation and trend. And, you know, enter, I guess, 9/11, in which Muslims were either forced to change gears or actively chose to change gears. I think it's a mixture of both, whereby they could no longer have really the luxury of just being engineers and physicians and because the whole world was talking, the whole world, meaning the whole country, was talking about who Muslims are and who the Muslims aren't. And I think, again, me being in college, I can speak to my experience and that of my friends and colleagues. We decided what, okay, people are talking about who we are or not, and maybe we don't even know, so we got to figure this thing out. A, as Muslims, and B, as Americans, or maybe, you know, A, as Americans, and B, as Muslims, and you see interchangeably what I mean here. And with that, you see a whole generation of reaching across the aisle, and I like the question, of activists and agents of American social change. Muslims doing all kinds of fantastic, awesome things in Institute for Social Policy Understanding, ISPU, to bring it full circle, has some awesome raw data on Muslim professions and where they're at. And you see an increase of Muslim presence even in pop culture that we take for granted. It's no longer, you know, the ugly Arab guy with the big nose and, you know, the sheik, right, Jafar and Aladdin, what was my time. Or the, you know, remember Sally Fields, Not Without My Daughter. That was the only guy you know from that part of the world that was ever in a film. And he was beating up his wife and kidnapping her and, you know, putting her in an apartment in Iran.
And 6 seasons of Bad Guys on 24.
Right. So, I mean, you see, but now you see an increase of just admitting, first of all, and deconstructing those types of problems in pop culture. And with that, you're seeing a huge increase in engagement of American Muslims that me, who's in civil rights, say they're going to be really the ultimate weapon in this fight for, you know, fight against stereotypes and equal treatment. And it's the success stories of American Muslim students, a success story of generation of Muslims proud to be Muslim and very proud to be American. And they're working on the two and living the two lives in a great balance and great engagement, and I think their communities are going to be better off for it, and I know the country will be as well.
And that's why I co-host another show on Fridays with Dr. Saba Maarouf. She's absolutely fantastic, and her show is called Unsung Heroes, and every single week she brings in someone to talk about, you know, being that success story, the work that we're doing primarily in and around the Muslim community, or not even necessarily around the Muslim community. Like, hey, I'm, you know, I might be an immigration lawyer. Hey, I work with adoption, and it's really cool to I'm going to use the word humanize only because I think that a lot of Muslims through the rhetoric have been dehumanized. Not that I don't see Muslim people as human, but I think putting flesh and blood, you know, just flesh, real flesh on people to let them know, hey, they have the same concerns and the same drive to succeed as I do. I think that I think that's very important. I love the work that she's doing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually what I was just about to touch on as well. I think that, you know, when you're thinking about, like, reaching across the aisle, I think that the best way to do that, the best way to foster religious tolerance is just to be someone that meets other people and becomes friends with them outside of your own, like, immigrant or Muslim community. I mean, you know, in my family and, like, in the families of our close family friends, you know, we all have made a point of trying to, you know, become friends with the people in our neighborhood and people of different faiths and have dinner with them. And, you know, I think that has really helped people see, oh, you know what, honestly, these Muslim people are just like us. They're just trying to have a good life for their family and they're just working hard. And some of these people were some of our friends that we've made over the years were the ones who were the most appalled and saddened when they heard about the Muslim ban, because they think of us and they think of some of their other friends and think, wow, this is targeting these people who I, like, know and I quite trust and who I like and who I think are just like me. So I think that's honestly the best way to reach across the aisle, just build friendships and build relationships with people that really humanizes, like you were talking about, it and kind of takes the mystery and the mystique away of, like, what is this group of people actually like? And on that note, I actually have to head out.
Yeah, absolutely. You said you had to be out by 7, so thanks for staying a few minutes over. Yeah, we'll finish out, and I'll let you know in this post, okay?
Beautiful. Thanks so much. Take care, guys.
Thanks for being on.
Take care.
You know, a friend of mine during the 2008 election told me this story about he's an ophthalmologist, and a patient of his come in, and somehow the topic of the election came up, and the patient made this comment, well, you know, I don't know who I'm going to vote for, but I'm not going to vote for Obama because he's a Muslim. And my friend, you know, being a Muslim, ended up engaging him in a conversation. And I guess the guy didn't realize that that his physician was a Muslim. And the question that he posed to him was, well, how are you comfortable with someone with trusting your life in the hands of a Muslim physician, but you know you can't perceive the possibility of having a Muslim president or a political leader.
You let me shoot a laser into your eyes. laser
beam, quote unquote. Yeah. And so I think that there's two sort of arenas for these conversations to take place. One, you know, unfortunately or fortunately, the battleground for the hearts and minds of most Americans takes place in the media. And I think that there's a lot of great examples in the past where other minorities have been able to use the media to humanize themselves in a situation where they were largely misunderstood. And two examples I can think of is Will and Grace and Ellen.
Ellen,
and
absolutely.
Her coming out episode and the role that that played in shaping
the Cosby Show that presented the black family as.
Yep. Absolutely.
And now Blackish.
And so one of the things that we're talking about, and Blackish is also a great example. One of the things that we're talking about is not just showing positive examples of the Muslim community in the United States and globally, but also a textured and nuanced picture of who Muslims are. And so that's looking at both, demographics, ethnicity, class, the issues within the community that we're struggling with. I think those are all very important things to consider when Muslims are and in the way that they should be engaging with the larger audience. The other part of it is more on a grassroots level. So Solomon brought up a number of good examples of how we can be talking to our neighbors and befriending people. But also I think the onus is on the larger community as well is to actively play a role and have some intellectual honesty and try to vet their own perceptions of not only Muslims but other religious and ethnic communities who are misunderstood. And try to understand what are their views on it, and are those views vetted, and are those views accurate, and then make overtures and try to reach out and try to make those friendships. I think that's profoundly important.
Okay. Well, I mean, there are plenty of studies that show that the overwhelming number of Americans still say they've never met a Muslim.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the overwhelming number of Americans who know a Muslim have a very positive view of not just them, but of Islam as a whole. And of the larger Muslim community. I think that there's several areas where we see, dare I use the word optimism for Fatima, where you see things changing. First of all, for example, here in the month of Ramadan, there are interfaith iftars, breakings of fast happening all the time. In fact, there was one tonight at a church. So you see this kind of convergence happening.
Myers has a Ramadan session.
Myers has a Ramadan session.
Yeah, I saw that.
But I think that's also important. So let me just pivot to that. Mm. Economics are going to drive this. What you see in the media is one image that's formed, but let's face it, the media is now being more and more mistrusted across the board. Mm-hmm. So it really then comes down to cultural production. Someone like, say, an Aziz Ansari, who is out there. Who knows? Aziz may be the Muslim community's Ellen, sort of a gateway. I mean, I know that sounds kind
His
of
His show,
strange...
Master of None on Netflix, is fantastic, by the way.
So you see this happening. I mean, what it's going to basically be is that when positive images of Muslims are going to be leading to higher ratings, higher ad buy, that's going to change the perception of Muslims. But in the interim, coalition building is happening all the time. The fact that Muslims are going to be part of an emerging majority it has to be taken into account. And we find that what were transactional relationships are now starting to change into transformational relationships with Muslims and others. I like to say that we have entered a post-Kumbaya period, that after 9/11, it was a bunch of people from various faiths getting together. I'm a Christian, you're a Muslim, don't shoot. But now it's coming down to something that's more concrete. And I would say it's perhaps more civic. that here we're finding these kinds of coalitions are forming in a way to move society in a positive direction. And from that, then, will probably yield political engagement that is also similarly inclusive.
Awesome. Well, thank you all so much for being here this week. And again, every time we do this, we get a little bit further. We get a little bit more understanding. And again, this is just part two of five that we're going to do throughout this year. And all of you, of course, are welcome back. Are welcome back on the show anytime. Thank you so much for engaging here. Thanks so much for listening to Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. Make sure you check out our website, leadingquestionsnow.com, where you can find all of our episodes from this season and last season, bios, a calendar of upcoming topics, and even suggest topics for us to talk about. If you're interested in bringing our program out to your college, university, or organization, email us at hello@leadingquestionsnow.com, and we'll get back to you. To our live listeners, thanks for tuning in. To those of you listening on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or SoundCloud, thanks so much for subscribing. Please leave us a rating. And tune in next week, where Kent and I have invited on a group of diverse people to discuss the question of, am I black enough?
Also, tune in on Friday for Unsung Heroes, because I will be the special guest.
No!
To talk about how I have not gotten enough credit for being a hero.
Oh, you got me. I thought she had invited you on. That would have been so cool. Oh, well. No. I can invite you on. Anyhow, so we will see you guys next week.